Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Those of you who were not here last night won't know who I am. Sorry about that. We have handed out tonight, which we tried to do last night, but we hadn't spoken our own precepts about a developmental state. We got the document too late to extramural studies, so they only got it for us tonight. But I hope it sets out a little bit about the background of this series and gives you a very short guide to some reading. We try to choose the reading because when you dig into it, you'll see a wealth of other references and information about this whole debate about states and development and the role of states. Last night, in the first lecture, of course, Anna Moyo, someone who's worked a great deal in Africa and also been in government in Zimbabwe and now in the African Development Bank, made a pretty blunt assessment of what he thought the African state's capacity was for delivery, and it was very low. He proffered some pretty radical propositions around why or how we should change that, essentially arguing for far greater professionalism in state structures. I'm not sure that radicalism is feasible, but I'm certainly sure about the fact that he was right to remind us that we in Africa shouldn't be complacent about what states are and what they should do. And in this evening's lecture, I'd like to pursue some of those issues a little bit further. I would argue that all too often when we discuss or raise the issue of a developmental state, for those of you not from South Africa, this is a topic that's come up in the last few years in South Africa quite a lot. We tend to take the state part as a given and focus on the developmental aspect and see it as a problem of policy, implementation and delivery. But this evening I'm going to really argue that if we're serious about this developmental process, we have to interrogate the concept of a state much more carefully before we get to the developmental dimension of it. Now, it's not my intention to be too theoretical, but I want to try and get to grips rather with issues which I think are going to be crucial for all of us in shaping the South African state, and that experience, along with what is happening in Africa anyway, may offer some insights into what we do in Africa as a whole. Now, in South Africa, we've only very recently come out of what was a truly titanic battle for the control of state power. We've established a democracy, there's no doubt, but we still face two very fundamental, elemental challenges for the stability of any society. Firstly, how do we actually build a nation that is confident in its diversity? And secondly, how do we develop our economic resources to provide for high levels of income and probably as important, particularly in South Africa, equity within our society? But let me start with the notion of a state. I mean, the state appears as a given in most social discourse. And I would argue that this all too easily lures us into a complacency. We're in fact using an implicit template. State's got borders, it's got a government, there must be elections, and we have endless measurable magnitudes that we can report in our national accounts and compare in World Bank statistics, etc. It seems to be something relatively homogeneous, something relatively precise, but I'm going to argue that in reality, particularly in the developing world, the reality is very different. It is not that. In some ways, states, I think, are like an elephant. We all know what it is, if you've seen it. But try and describe that to someone who's never seen it. And I think states are not too far off. If you actually try and describe in detail, what is a state? What does it do? It's a pretty long story you've got to tell. And what we do in practice is we condense that into the simple template and we work with states as a given, but usually we then go on to make an error, and that is we start casting our analysis and our proposed solutions on the basis of the state in its template form. But I think there's a lot more to a developmental state than merely an invocation by a government of the day saying we're a developmental state. In fact, I think that's a dangerous mistake. There's a lot more to it, and what I'd like to explore a little bit this evening is what is that more. And I hope that as we do this, we'll identify some of the key endeavours that we as citizens, and as I said last night, this is one of the themes of these series of lectures, is the role of citizenry. That we as citizens, singularly and collectively, will have to take seriously, very seriously, if we want to aspire to development or a developmental state in South Africa and certainly Africa. But I have to begin by getting out of the way a little bit a perennial question, a question very hotly debated amongst economists, political economists, amongst political theories, as to whether the state should in fact play a role in the economy. On the one extreme, you've got the position that the state shouldn't be in the economy. It should facilitate, it should be out of the economy. And the other extreme, that basically the state should replace market forces and plan the economy. Now, actually, in practice, to the best of my knowledge, neither of these extremes have ever existed in reality. And I think it's also the case that the role of the state over even capitalist history has varied very widely. Even in contemporary developed and industrialized economies, there's actually quite a wide divergence. However, this divergence is often in form rather than content. Those of you familiar with the economies of the United Kingdom and France, at a superficial glance, you would argue that, well, in France, the state plays a very dominant role, as it does. And we'd argue that in the United Kingdom, particularly after the Thatcher period, the state plays a much reduced role, which it does. But I'd urge you to go and look at it a little bit more closely. And when you dig into it, you would find that the actual influence on the economy is just achieved by very different mechanisms. There's an OECD ranking on the direct control the government has on corporations in the economy. And if I'm not mistaken, the United Kingdom is ranked number one. And it does this through much more sophisticated shareholder agreements, golden share agreements, the Office of Shareholder Affairs, whereas France does it through the ownership of some extremely large companies and global companies. So I'm making this point because, by and large, there's a lot of clutter and noise around this debate of the state and the economy. And what I'm working on is a much more pragmatic approach, and I think all of us in this lecture series are working on the same pragmatic approach, that basically the state will play a role in an economy that will differ in time and place. We'd also argue, and we're going to use two examples in the next two lectures on environment and energy, that there's certain key economic objectives in which the state inevitably has to play a decisive role. And as I said, these would be environment and energy as two examples. There are others. I'm also working on the assumption that it's actually very hard to show historical examples where development hasn't been strongly influenced or directed or guided by state activity. Now, I know we could debate this for a long time. It's one of the hottest, horriest debates in economics and political economy. But for me, it's becoming somewhat of an abstract debate divorced from reality. And the reality seems to me that the state plays a role in all economies. The real question that we have to look at from time to time, and I stress that from time to time, because it's not unchangeable over time, is the role that the states choose to play, and probably much more importantly, how effectively they are structured to play that role. So in this lecture, my focus is a little bit more on the state rather than the role that it may play in the economy for the purposes of development. Now, my basic proposition is that in the contemporary era, and we could spend time discussing why it's just a temporary error. There has to be a degree of social cohesion and technical competence within state institutions if they are to be able to effectively achieve development. Let me repeat that. A degree of social cohesion within the state and technical competence within state institutions if they are to be effective developmental states. More complex and difficult, and I'm going to try and elaborate on this in the next few minutes, is that achieving these properties, the two things, social cohesion, technical competence, requires profound changes within the society located, I'm choosing my words very carefully, within the society located within the borders of the nation state. I think why I'm stressing this will come to you in a moment. So I want to examine these required changes at three levels, as I think these areas are decisive in defining the actual workings of state institutions, and it's the actual workings of state institutions that are going to give rise to development. Firstly, how does the functioning of a state depend on its genesis? Secondly, how is state power achieved and then changed so that the state's institutions function purposefully? And thirdly, how are state institutions structured for it to operate effectively and coherently? Sounds simple? But I think that's the very substance of it. So, I would venture to suggest that as we try to answer these questions, we will begin to identify more carefully the very real societal and political endeavours that face us in Africa in our quest for development. There are no templates, there's no simplicity. Let me start with this concept of the genesis of the state. Now, I'm simplifying, and my apologies to the historians that are probably in the audience, but I would argue that the basic conception of the modern state, the template as I referred to it earlier, is in fact a product of Western European history in the last two or three centuries, probably two really. And if I simplify the template, these are not insignificant achievements, but let's just simplify the template for a moment. What are we talking about? We're talking about fixed geographic territory, i.e. stable boundaries, a national governance structure that accrues unto itself sovereignty. Important word in governance. Accrues unto itself sovereignty over and above other social structures. Some of the salience of some of these points, I hope, will become a little bit more precise in a moment. The right to govern that structure, the custodian, if you like, of that structure, is decided by an elective process based on the equality of individual rights. We're going to come back to this. It's important. And, very important, and an acceptance that there will be majority rule. Those that win the election will rule. And there is, and we discussed this a little bit last night in a slightly different context, and then there is therefore a very special role for the judiciary whose task it is to adjudicate on this legislative dispensation. Now we can start thinking about how important those achievements are, because just a moment's reflection will make it quite clear that the majority of the world's states in contemporary history that don't function like that. If we look historically, very different situation. Sovereignty derived from, not from the franchise at all, but from the divine, or from pure power. You've all done your history, read about the divine right and all the nonsense that we had to chop off people's heads to solve. So, sovereignty derived from something external, the divine. Borders existed not to be stable, but to be expanded. Those states that weren't creating empires fell behind. So the concept of stable borders, fixed borders, aren't they? And basically government was a question of what's right is might, what might is right. Pretty much, for most history. So, something important happens in Europe. Once it had exhausted itself through warfare, and the other historians can confirm, man, that continent was riven with warfare for a long time. Once it had exhausted itself with warfare, and once its ability to control this massive empire that it created in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries began to decline, basically Europe came to its senses. And it began to agree a system of defined nation states. It achieved one of the greatest achievements, I think, in political human history. It went even further, and it built a super state, the European Union, in less than 50 years. Quite a remarkable achievement. The emergence of the United States was an important transplant, with some modifications we're all familiar with, of this model. But the stark reality is that for the rest of the world's states that exist today, they're essentially a product of European imperialism. China is probably an exception, if you look a little more closely. Africa is certainly probably the most graphic example of this global realpolitik. There's been some wonderful books published recently on the idiosyncrasies of the borders. I don't know how many of you know this, but we've got one of the weirdest borders under the sun. Between South Africa and Namibia, our border is on the northern bank of the Orange River. International law says the border is in the middle. But Namibia and South Africa, Namibia didn't have much choice in it. And Namibia was told, no, the border's on your northern border. I mean, all common sense says you should change it. But as we're going to see in a moment, that's quite difficult in Africa, changing those borders. So I'm just trying to illustrate the idiosyncrasy of our borders that were imposed. So essentially, in Africa and Asia to a lesser extent, but not an insignificant extent, it was imperial might that imposed systems upon the societies, and the system they imposed had very little in common with the indigenous systems of governance that had then existed in those societies. And bear in mind, we're not talking about long ago now. We're talking about the borders was 1895, I think, wasn't it? Berlin Treaty. And independence and all these other things. No, we're talking, I mean, 100 years in history is a blink of an eye. So we're not talking about a long time. And I think the enormity of this situation is usually entirely overlooked when we talk about Africa. And we start assuming that the states take the template comes into play. Because the reality is too complex to describe, by and large. Probably, though, an even more interesting aspect of this whole phenomenon of the creation of Africa's states was the clear decision by the leaders of the anti-colonial struggle, African leaders, to actually accept this geographic reality. I don't think they did it because they felt that there was some magnificent sanctity in the democracy that was being imposed on them. If you remember your colonial history and neo-colonial history, democracy was a pretty funny concept in most of those places. I think rather it was just a hard-nosed, practical assessment of the balance of power. And in fact, the neo-colonial regime didn't give you much room for experimentation. The OAU in 1960, if I'm not mistaken, makes the decision that Africa's borders will stay. That's why we can't change the border in Namibia. If we do, chaos. We have, of course, and I'm going to come back to this, we've got one of the most interesting events in Africa's history taking place right now, and that is Sudan. So, but I'm afraid this acceptance of those borders has not and does not and could not remove the underlying issues. I mean, quite clearly, Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, as I mentioned a second ago, Somalia, Cote d'Ivoire, many others. These are expressions of some very complex underlying tensions that are emerging within these geographic borders created by realpolitik. Because in reality, a state form that relies on electoral success and majority rule, as I described earlier, requires a very clear distinction between the state as an institution and the government of the day and its political sponsors. Patronage and concentrations of power have to be systematically and institutionally curbed and even eliminated if possible. Not easy. Yet for most of the world's societies, patronage and concentration of power was the actual social cement that kept the society together. So in Africa, surely it's inevitable. It's true of other parts of the world too, if you're focusing on Africa. Surely it's inevitable that we, in our societies, are very much still in the throes of a gigantic and profound change in the structure of our societies. I think to their great credit, the anti-colonial leaders of that time realized that the older structures would not survive the processes of industrialization, trade, and communication that had been ushered in by global capitalism. You only have to read their writings to see how profoundly and deeply they understood this issue. They chose to modernize their societies. And I think this was another important reason why the imposed nation-states were accepted as a fait accompli. It was actually quite a useful vehicle to modernize your much more complex society. And I want to stress this. I think any attempt to interpret recent post-colonial and colonial history of Africa as somehow atavistic is to make a mistake. I believe African leaders, anti-colonial leaders, chose to join the stream of history. But it's been very difficult because they've been buffeted in that stream by continuous and persistent interventions from more powerful economies and states. But the reason I'm stressing this reality is not an excuse or anything, it's an historical reality. The reason I'm stressing it is because at the time that the European states, and they're the only ones who do it, and the first ones, the time that they form what we now understand as the modern democratic form, a high degree of cultural coalescence had already occurred within their borders. This had been achieved by force, by contact, sometimes just by the passage of time. I don't know about you, because I'm older than all of you, I guess, but I spent an inordinate amount of time when I was a kid studying the travails of my Scottish and Irish ancestors as they got absorbed into the United Kingdom. I spent a lot of time studying the reforms, mainly language and other reforms of Napoleon after the French Revolution. That's what made France. It wasn't there before. I studied Bismarck and Garibaldi for Germany and Italy. Actually, I spent very little time studying Africa. No one told me anything about it when I was a student. So I really was a bloody ignoramus when it came to my own continent. But really, I think what had happened in these European states was a very high degree of cohesion that formed at a national level. But diversity was tolerated. Now, we could go into a lot more detail on this, and there are distinct differences between Africa and Europe, but let's just work for the moment a more simple model that basically a high degree of national cohesion, but a tolerance of diversity. In the United Kingdom, France, many of these areas, you see this in very complex forms. But whatever happened, the real point I want to make here is that the process was long and painful. So it is surely expecting almost the absurd to hope that if I come along and impose from an external source a border on you, that will mean that some national cohesion will form within that border. And this is why I stressed earlier the society within the border. And take a modern day Iraq. What is the society in Iraq? It was formed in 1921. It's got all sorts of currents and groups and ethnicities across it. Africa is the same. What is the society in it? the people in it, but the society is a different note. Society presupposes some cohesion and interaction. So I think my argument is that this ability to achieve, usually painfully, a balance between cohesion but a tolerance of diversity, it is this that marks out stable and effective states. How they achieve it, many varied paths to achieve that. Because basically this cohesion allows people to understand and accept that there are times when the common national good is going to be more important than their national or community good. And this in turn engenders some degree of patience, because frankly, development can never be instantaneous. It's always going to be a give and take process. It's always going to be uneven in space and time. So a focus on common good generates some degree of ability of, to have perspective. You only have to visit China to understand that. Some degree to have a perspective. But a focus on the personal or the community good tends to gravitate towards the achievement of short-term objectives and more instantaneous solutions, a disaster in a complex state. We've got some wonderful and sad and tragic examples. I mean, if there's no prospect of a national economy, piracy is a hell of a practical alternative. Now, in South Africa, I want to argue that the prospects for this nation-building process, i.e. of achieving a dynamic balance between cohesion and diversity, is in fact good. We're one area of Africa where a process of forcing compliance, it was a real serious process. To the best of my knowledge, probably South Africa and Zimbabwe, maybe Algeria, I mean, the historians might want to correct me, are the only places where the colonial administration was able to exert complete control over the whole territory. In most other countries, the control was fairly tenuous in large parts of the territory. It certainly happened very late, usually only a 10, 20-year period before independence. So, in South Africa, this process did take place. By 1910, a serious process of forced compliance with a nation state in its formal form had been achieved. Very painful battle, very painful battle. But very importantly, the anti-colonial leaders that arose in response to that were surprising, in my view, real modernizers. They really understood the integrative pressures on their society that global capitalism was going to bring them. They wrote about it eloquently and beautifully in the Atlantic Charter submissions in 1941. They really understood this. They also deeply understood, again, magnificently set out in 1941, the profound humanism which actually underlies the concept of human rights or individual rights. They understood this. Because in some ways it accorded with the concept of an individual in Ubuntu, broadly speaking. We in South Africa, we stood back from a horrible abyss. Many of us have forgotten how black and horrible that abyss looked. We stood back and we said, no, we're not going there, we're going to negotiate. And we negotiated. We set up a truly enlightened constitution, an asset to be treasured and fought for, as I'll come back to. So I think there's a great potential in South Africa to continue this complex process of nation building. Balance between cohesion and diversity, which Mandela captured in his Rainbow Nation concept. However, there's also no doubt in my mind that the momentum of that process can easily be lost if we leave it entirely to traditional political parties and governments. We have to have some form of wider societal endeavor if we to continue the nation building process. Now this may sound like some grand dream. It's not. It's actually a highly practical proposition. All it needs is a mindset in our individual minds which says, I'm going to take on the responsibility for nation building. Me, personally. So I'm going to play a role in my business, my trade union, my university, my community, my family. And what am I going to do? What I know is I must try and encourage cohesion and learn to respect and understand diversity. So, I must engage. The only way you can respect is to understand. So I need to engage. I need to get out there, talk to people, engage, understand them. Yeah. Get a constant energy going. Because it's enjoyable, actually. As we've seen sometimes on our sporting occasion. Enjoyable getting out there, doing this. But we haven't been so good at that in South Africa. And we need to. Campaigns like Lead South Africa might sound a bit trite. It's on the radio every day. I wouldn't underestimate the importance of things like that. I think these are important. Continual, constant energy, which says that we assume the responsibility of building a nation. But we didn't start as a nation. We started as settlers from all over Europe. We started as big, powerful tribes and states. We started as all sorts of funny things. We now have absorbed large numbers of people to the rest of Africa. Building that into a nation requires damn hard work. So, if we're doing it, we're building nations. But if citizens abdicate this responsibility and leave everything to government and traditional political processes, then we're going to be basically condemning the state to ineffectualness and developmental inertia. The scourge that we discussed last night that characterizes. Let me turn to the next key level and issue that I think is crucial. These are not far abstract issues, but part of our day-to-day life and living. Now, this positive nation building that I've just been advocating, I guess, is really a form of sociological, maybe even socio-psychological mobilization. And so, we might want to call it, someone last night referred to, common cultural values, the building of these things. It's common and diverse, balance. I think if this is present, it becomes much easier to make complicated, difficult choices and decisions, and it's those complicated, difficult choices and decisions that lead to development, as we've seen in other societies that have done this. But we now have to address this issue of state power. How is it decided? How is it structured? Now let's look at this a little bit more closely than we tend to do on CNN and BBC, where an election must happen today. John made a point here today. An electoral process based on individual rights and the full franchise for the adult population is something that evolved very painfully in Europe. And what was it, 1930 or something, when it became full in most countries? Less. Not long ago. So this system of an election on the full franchise for all adults is very new in fact. And I would argue that the key factor in Europe's ability to do this was in fact the increased levels of social cohesion. And as important, the emergence of clear political groupings based essentially on their class perspective and the associated ideology. Capital and labor, and capital social, and we're all familiar with that massive body of literature from Marx and many, and Faber and many others assessing this process. What happened in these societies? What was the coalescence of political forces that defeated the Ancien regime, that removed aristocracy, that did all those kind of things? And what you ended up with by the 20th century, mainly. So remember, this is pretty new then. By the 20th century, you end up with a preponderance of bi-party states. Why? Not because two is good, but essentially that's how the political formations formed, essentially based around class interests. Now, this was a template that emerged at the same time as colonialism reaches its height. You have this weird situation of democracy as we now understand it in the center, an absolute lack of democracy in the territories. So the template really gets imposed on these former colonies at a point when the social formations in those colonies had nothing similar was going on in those formations as to what had happened in Europe. In fact, with a very slight partial exception of South Africa, there was an industrial working class. People were still attached to the land. There was no proletariat. There was no concept of individual rights. I was part of a clan or a tribe or a family. We're not talking about 700 years ago. We're talking about 50 years ago, 60 years ago. So, what did exist, this is very important, what did exist for Africans was a very clear oppressor. The colonial power, or in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Algeria, a settler power. So to change that didn't depend on some democratic process as was understood by Western states. It actually depended on mass mobilization across classes in order to get maximum support. And this is where what happens is you get the rise of the great mass parties, ANC being one of the greatest. You get these large mass parties that rise. Not only in Africa, but the great parties of India, the Congress parties under Gandhi and Nehru, the Chinese under Mao Zedong, following a communist philosophy, but nonetheless, large parties, mass parties, mobilizing. And if you read the history carefully, you'll see they mobilize across classes. They don't become exclusive. So, it's these great mass parties that evolve. Their object is not to share power from time to time with another government. Their object is to seize state power, to remove the governments of the day. And in fact, these mass parties were a very, very important part of nation building. If you listen to them, if you watch a Patrice Lumumba in a complex place like the Congo, a devastated place, they used the mass parties to try and build a national identity. Because what they had to do was to encourage a national perspective. In cases like South Africa, an international perspective. Over and above your common community or individual interests. You had to be persuaded. Join this difficult fight. Usually not an easy fight, huh? It wasn't a free ride. You were bugging up, basically, if you joined the fight. So, this was an important way of creating a national identity. So when we look at Africa's parties, we shouldn't start comparing them to the current parties in Western industrial countries. The much closer analogies are Cromwell, Napoleon, Garibaldi, the people who did the same thing in the developed industrial countries, forced their way through to create national identities. The ordered Westminster system is an extremely remote reality for the developing world. As I'll argue in a moment, it may not even be a sensible one. So, I think for us in Africa, for the developing world, but let me focus on Africa, some of the discussions we had last night, where these mass parties have existed, we have to familiarize ourselves with a completely different historiography. It's an historiography of the path of these mass movements. First, their ability to mobilize across class, where they existed, tribe, ethnicity, language. I mean, in South Africa we've got 11 or 12 languages. I think Nigeria is 49 or 50. Tanzania is 30, I don't know, massive. So they mobilize, first the history of how did they manage that? How did they manage this amazing feat, Indian Congress Party, of mobilizing in short period of 10, 20 years. The ANC is the oldest, 90 years. Short period, they mobilize across those classes. How did they do that? What allowed them to do it? How did they seize power? By many very different paths, many very different paths. But now we enter a different period. Now a mass party has to govern an embryonic, and I stress that word, embryonic nation state. This is largely uncharted historical waters. Largely uncharted. I think all of us who read about it, we can learn a great deal from India and the Congress Party. We can certainly learn a great deal about current events in China. There's some African transitions which have been amazing. We can learn about it. South Africa is a history in the making. But it's uncharted territory. So if we want to know what's happening in the present, we mustn't look out the wrong window. We've got to look out of the window of our own historiography. And that's what many leaders have been saying in Africa. It's not the disrespect for the West or dislike of the West. Just saying, guys, it's not the history that's going to inform us of what we need to do about us. Yes, we can get ideas from it. I'm going to come to one of the most important ideas of the lot that we can get from Europe in a moment. But we have to understand our own historiography. In fact, there's a very plausible argument, was argued powerfully, and I think it's probably true, that a multi-party democracy in the kind of situation I've described in Africa might actually lead to a major setback for nation building. Because the parties might end up merely reflecting entrenched ethnic, communal, or regional differences. They don't constitute contending national political forces. In fact, there can be little doubt that the political fragmentation that's characterized Africa after the 70s has really led to very fractious, weak governments that we discussed last time. Because the truth is, Africa is not poor in resources. Africa is one of the great resource baskets of this planet. What Africa is poor at is mobilizing that resource. And this has got a lot to do with political fragmentation and the weak states that we're looking at. Now, this transition that I've referred to from being a mass party to having to govern an embryonic nation state, I think is an exceptionally complex process. We can spend a few lectures on this alone. And I hope that John Mitchell-Tenzi in the last lecture will say a little bit about this in the South African context, as the ANC, this great liberation movement, confront some of its own extremely difficult problems. But I want to make two concluding points, but we don't have time to go into that complexity. I think we have to understand Africa and the historiography of anti-colonial and anti-apartheid struggles if we are to successfully forge democratic responses to this transition. The politics of contemporary industrialized countries cannot be a template for us, especially when they start getting a bit messianic about their civilizing mission. But secondly, and more importantly, because we are facing a major structural transformation in the political projects of our countries, we as citizens need to be active. We must engage. We must not sit in the convenient old corners. I'm in ANC because I've always been ANC. I'm in the DA because they seem to be nice chaps. We have to engage. And I think the political guidelines for citizens must be clear. For me, they're clear. What we want are political parties or movements, because the precise form is still a bit of an open question in my view, political parties or movements that consolidate nation building through their inclusivity, they generate a capacity and a discipline to serve, some of the stuff we discussed last night, capacity and a discipline to serve. If you think of the great Scandinavian social democratic parties, they developed this in a very powerful measure, this discipline to serve. And you display a vision and wisdom, because we've got some difficult choices ahead. So what we want from political parties, because you need them, or political movements, is that inclusivity, an ability to serve and create the disciplines for that service, and a vision and a leadership capacity that can take us through some difficult, difficult times ahead. Unfortunately, we're slipping into the kind of mishmash of advanced country media where politics is a dirty, self-enriching game, and if you're a good person, you should stay out of it. Well, I'm telling you now, if this remains the case, we're going to have a very, very painful self-fulfilling prophecy, which I suspect is what some of the developed countries got. And we're going to regret it. So now is the time for good people to get into politics. That's my concluding point on this issue of changing power at the state. Good people should get into politics. Finally, state capacity. Last night, Nkosana took this by the bull by the horns and said, you've got to be more professional. I'm going to get there by a slightly more circuitous route, probably because he was a physicist and I was an economist. Let's go back and reflect. Individual rights only have meaning and content if they are enshrined and protected in something outside interpersonal and group power. Think about it for a moment. If I've got an individual right and it's mine, something must give it to me and enshrine it outside of my father, my mother, my chief, my policeman, or whatever. And I think this is really, if you think about it, the origin of the modern constitution, which is effectively the removal of sovereignty from persons, kings, dukes, emperors, and its location within a set of social rules, i.e. the constitution, most finely developed by the republican movements and others only a few hundred or so years ago, 150 years. Now central to this is that the actual institutions of state have to operate according to the law. And there has to be a credible recourse for me, the individual, to establish my rights, the judiciary. Whew, think about that. That is a very complicated proposition. Very complicated proposition. And really, it is this proposition that is Europe's great contribution to the advance of humanity. It is that proposition. Defining, defending, and creating the structure where individual rights have meaning. For those of us, like myself, who will struggle for democracy, that is what we're struggling for. That is at the heart of what Europe gave to the world. And really, it's a pity it came with a lot of baggage, lots of guns and imperialism and other things, but many, many African leaders, to their great credit, many leaders in the developing world, could see that this proposition was an advance for humanity. Forget the baggage, forget the oppression, there's a proposition that belongs to humanity, not to the West. I think that's a very important proposition, because if we have a structure that protects individual rights, sets the rules, then you can understand why majority rule can work. Because I know that the winners have to abide by the same rules I've got to abide by. Important proposition there. Because there's some degree of social cohesion, I've also got a fair understanding of the degree of change that's likely to occur when one government moves to another. I know roughly what they're going to do. That's why the social cohesion is important. I've got confidence in the system. I know how it's going to work, how it's going to change. And it's this that is the basis for the stable two-party electoral systems that Europe characterized. But of course, as we now see, even these are undergoing change. We've got a proliferation of governments of national unity and all sorts of funny things happening. And I think there are good reasons for that. But they don't detract from the basic proposition that these are stable electoral systems, based on the rights. The other thing that's crucial is that the state, in its functioning, has to be predictable. And here I think the concept of professionalism, what Kosana was alluding to last night, is important. I think for me, professionalism is something where a person's work is governed by a code of conduct and performance that is external to themselves and agreed by the peers. So it removes caprice, it removes unpredictability, patronage, and this is important. It's why professions where there's a lot at stake, medicine, probably law, many others, engineering, tend to evolve these codes, these professions. That's why they're professions. So my argument, as was in Kosana's last night, there has to be a concerted attempt to professionalize the public service, because clearly serving in the state is a vital social function. It's a vital social function. We have to professionalize. There are a lot of practical issues on this we could go into, but at its heart, the basic fundamental precept is, in order for you to professionalize, you have to ensure that there is a clear division between the political decision-making process and the structures and the people that then implement those decisions. And most of the time, remember, they're not implementing the decisions of the political parties, they're just carrying out basic functions. So it's crucial that we begin to institutionalize this and create a division and make sure it exists. I think, I don't have time to pursue this too much, but by moving the whole concept of a public service up to the concept of being a professional cadre of peoples, you get more skill. And here was a question raised last night, I'm not sure it was the intent, but I think it would be an extremely serious mistake for any state to underestimate the importance of modern ICT technology. Basically, you can completely and absolutely revolutionize state administration by effective introduction of ICT technology. Most of our states still have a very deadweight overhang of the old clerical masses that the colonial era had. Remember, the colony had a lot of clerks because the colony had to check on its assets. The purpose of the administration wasn't to service the public, it was to make sure it didn't steal the bloody assets of the crown. So we have this gigantic clerical bureaucracy that evolved. We've got to break that. We've got to get away from it. My argument, and we could spend time discussing it, we will maybe later in this series. Actually, we've got to get the highly skilled people to the interface of the community. Not so that they can get you to fill in forms, but so they can provide you magnificent broadband internet, tell you where to go look up problems of the law, tell you how to monitor the performance of government, give you information. That's what we should be doing. And this will allow states, which they're beginning to do in advanced countries, to form a partnership. It's not a client relationship between the bureaucracy of the state and the citizen. It's a partnership between active citizens and state power. State power being a concentration of resources that can be used for the common good. So, what do we as citizens do? What do we demand? Well, I think the first and foremost, and in South Africa we're fairly conscious of this, but it's important that we remain highly conscious, we have to protect our constitution. We have to protect the rule of law. This is the scaffolding for a democratic process. There's no question about it whatsoever. But I think then we should not only demand, but we should take active steps to try and get and create and assist these key issues of predictability from the public service, professionalism from the public service, and the mindset that says my job is to facilitate your life, not to administer it. If we can drive for that, I think we're starting to get states that are responsive. These are not far away possibilities. I mean, I would say to a high degree, many Scandinavian states are not far off this. Conclusion. As an academic, I'm always interested in the theoretical arguments about developmental states, Klaus, Marx, Hegel, all these horrible things saying, what would they read, Feuerbach, and all these funny, wonderful characters. But basically, the pragmatic part of me says that this theoretical debate is not our priority at the moment. But development is our priority. But to achieve this development, I think we have to accelerate the task of building effective states. And it's not a task to be left to traditional political processes alone, nor must we be trapped within the templates of the past. Citizens must be active, analysts and theoreticians sharp and innovative, and we can, I think, build developmental states if it becomes a societal project. And what I'm advocating is that as citizens, personal choice, not abstract choice, personal choice, we take responsibility for nation building by engaging up with our cultural diversity, understanding it, and learning to respect that diversity. Secondly, that we understand the very profound political changes now taking place in Africa. not ordinary politics, electoral politics, profound political changes. And rather than despair, we must engage to shape the new democracy that will and has to evolve on our continent. It's time to engage in political activity, not to shut it. And finally, as citizens, we must do all we can to protect the integrity of state institutions through the constitutions and through our demands for predictability, professionalism, and administrative accessibility. Now, we in South Africa are lucky in some ways. We pay for the luck. But we are a product of a particular history. And I think it's lent this embryonic nation a surprising degree of special social and political energy. And if we can't build on this, if we can't build on this, this generation, this us South Africans, if we can't build on it, we're truly going to fail this wondrous continent of Africa. Because we are massively blessed with human and natural endowments, more than any other country in Africa. So we must get off our asses and change the world. Thank you.